Episode 1433, My Strength is My Story with Sean Smucker, Once We Were Strangers.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a stop
sign, watching people drive. Happy, happy day. It is my favorite day of the week. It is my Strength is My Story series, and we have with us an incredible author. In fact, he's also a ghostwriter, Sean Smucker. Are you ready to take a journey with him? And you know what? That journey is of another man's story. For those of you who are brand new to Create You Now, friends and family of Sean's, welcome to our family. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already even had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. Well, little did Sean know how much a stranger would impact him. You see, this story is of another man's journey. What friendship with the Syrian refugee taught him about loving his neighbor. How do you love your neighbor? When you listen to this today, this holiday season will be a different season. Get ready for your heart to be palpitated with incredible joy and inspiration. Once We Were Strangers with Sean Smucker. Hello and welcome to Create You Now. I am so excited. We have with us a special guest. His name is Sean Smucker. He is a husband of 19 years to Miley and father to their 6 children. Between him and I, we got a football team. He is the author of Christianity Today 2018 Fiction Book of the Year, The Day the Angels Fell. And the book, The Edge of Over There, was just released July of 2018. However, his latest book might be his most compelling book, a nonfiction book, Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with the Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. Oh my goodness, Sean, I'm so excited to have you here, us connecting. Welcome, my friend and brother in Christ. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Christiane.
Oh, well, how was your Thanksgiving? I know you're just coming back from a holiday travel.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. My family always heads down to Charlotte to hang out with my wife's family for Thanksgiving. So it's an annual trek, and we love it down there. It's a nice break.
It is a nice break, and you didn't hit too much snow, did you?
No snow, but it was very rainy down there, and it was colder than usual. So that was a little bit different. But besides that, it was great.
Yeah. Well, you had probably really warm hearts when you're with family.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, what brings joy to your heart?
Oh, I love, you know, now that my kids are getting older and they have our oldest two are 14 and 15. So everybody kind of has the activities going on and the youth groups and the sports and all that stuff. And I love nights when we're all just home together. I love that. Like when we don't have anything on the schedule and we have dinner together and then we're just hanging out around the house. I love that a lot. I also get a ton of joy from reading. So I read as much as I can and spend most of my days writing. And I love that. I love that I get to do that for a living.
Wow. Well, what actually got you into writing?
Yeah, I was, I always loved to write. I started a daily journal practice probably when I was 17 or 18. And that got me into really good habits of writing daily. And I did that for years and years and years and always wanted to write a novel. That was kind of my long dream after a Sunday school teacher read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to us when I was a kid. But yeah, I got into writing full time after our painting. I had a painting business in Virginia. And in 2008, 2009, when the housing market crashed and the economy tanked, my wife and I were left with a ton of debt from that business. And so we moved back in with my parents, which was a difficult decision to make. I was in my early 30s. We had 4 kids at that point, and we moved into their basement. And we decided at that point that I was going to focus on writing for 6 months. I already had a couple of co-writing jobs lined up. And we were going to give it 6 months, and that was in 2009. And 10 years later, that's how I'm making a living. So, It was probably the hardest time of our life as far as the circumstances go, but it's pretty cool to see how that led into a really cool thing.
Oh, a really cool thing, and really a way for you to utilize your God-given gifts and talents.
Yeah. It was interesting. My wife had been praying a lot in the years leading up to that. We were both feeling pretty unsettled. And so when that happened, when we had to make that decision, we both felt like we were confused, you know, because we felt like we had done everything right. You know, we were making good choices. We were living the way we were supposed to live. And then here we were broke and in my parents' basement. And at one point, my wife's, you know, in prayer told God, you know, this is a pretty awful gift. But she didn't use the word awful. But as the years have passed, we've started to see how that, you know, really hard time ended up being truly a gift to our family.
And during the holidays, especially, I think we have a sense to go back and do a lot of reflection, even when we don't want to. It's in the air, you know, and shorter days and longer nights just kind of bring about that whole idea of wonderment. Would you have changed anything in the past?
No, I wouldn't. And, you know, I think there are probably times in my life where I would have, if given the opportunity. But I think as more time passes and once you can kind of see the long view of things, I think that helps me to have more peace with how things have turned out and where I'm at and where my family's at and that sort of thing. So I wouldn't change anything now.
Oh, well, that is awesome. I love hearing those kind of stories because in the middle of the mess, you want to change it all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, that was super hard. You know, we were, like I said, we were like $50,000 in debt and living in my parents' basement, starting from scratch, you know, which you don't want to do when you're in your early 30s with four kids. Like, you know, by that point, you kind of hope to be well on your way. But we were literally starting over. But like I said, it just ended up being such a wonderful journey.
And your journey has continued. In fact, you've written many fiction books, but you wrote Once We Were Strangers. What challenges did you face as a writer going from fiction to nonfiction?
Well, I make a living co-writing and ghostwriting memoirs for people. So for over the last 10 years, I've written I've co-written or ghostwritten a fair amount of memoirs. I think the unique challenge with Once We Were Strangers was I went into that book with the sense that it was going to be like all of those other memoirs, and in other words, focused on that person. So I really expected Once We Were Strangers to basically be Muhammad's story. I figured it would, you know, it would trace his life from Syria, his journey to Jordan, and then the United States. I didn't expect to have so much of the book be my internal struggles, or struggles probably isn't the word, but just sort of working through, you know, this new friendship and how I felt about, you know, all the things surrounding that. I didn't really plan on that being as big of a part in the book as it became.
Yeah, because in your book you write, Sean, hold on, let me flip to it here. I want to quote you. You say, to be honest, I know that I'm not a great friend. If I have the choice between hanging out and staying home, you know I choose home almost every time. I don't like it when other people depend on me because that requires something.
Yeah, I learned so much about myself through this journey with Muhammad. You know, I realized that I'm a very selfish person, basically. I mean, And by selfish, I mean for myself and my family, you know. So I want to spend time. I want to have time with my family. I want to have time with my kids and my wife. And so because we're so busy, it's easy to kind of push everyone else to the periphery of our lives. And if we happen to see you, or if we happen to, you know, cross paths at church, or we happen to maybe even have dinner once a year, like, wow, look at us. This is great, you know. But I think as I became friends with Muhammad, I started to realize what a true friendship looks like and what a true friendship requires of us. And I don't think that many of us are really equipped for that or have set up our lives in a way that allows for that here in the United States, just because of how busy we are and how many activities we're involved in and all that sort of thing.
Well, definitely life has changed. I mean, we look at our communication and the way we operate with how we talk to people. It's all mostly digital. Look at what we're doing now, which is incredible because we didn't know each other before digital. We would never have crossed paths. But that everyday interaction is totally different. What was your idea in lending a helping hand before you met Muhammad, and then how did it change?
Yeah, so when I first met Muhammad, I figured that I would be helping him read his mail, or maybe giving them some money if they needed it, or giving him rides places, just kind of the day-to-day stuff. I knew people who have money who I thought, well, if Muhammad needs something, if he needs a car or if he needs furniture, like I could, maybe get that stuff together and arrange it for him. But I realized pretty quickly that those resources are available to people whether or not I get involved. Like Church World Service is a wonderful refugee resettlement program here in Lancaster, an organization, and they really have things in place to help take care of that and volunteers in place that will do those sorts of things. And I realized with Muhammad, and since I've been friends with him, I've heard from so many other refugees and other people who've worked with refugees that what's really needed are friends. Like what these folks need are people who are willing to invite them into their lives, make them a part of their weekly, monthly routines, introduce them to their friends, because that's what they're lacking. You can come here and you can get a job, and you there are organizations that will help you get a car or furnish your home, or there are food banks where you can get food. So the basics, while extremely important, are basically available to people. What's not available is a replacement for the community that most of them have left. And when you're talking about Middle Eastern communities, you're talking about very tightly knit towns and villages where people spend hours together, not a week, but per day. And so for them, it's a very lonely experience, I think, to be dropped into the middle of this different culture.
So true. In fact, I was really intrigued by your title, Once We Were Strangers, but what captured my heart was the story. And I have read the book, and I can't wait for people to get their hands on it. In fact, you want to pick up your own copy of Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with the Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. Well, it did capture my heart, Sean. Tell us a little bit about Muhammad, because obviously people are like, okay, refugee, I'm getting that. But let's go back just a little bit.
Yeah, so when I first met Muhammad, I was already doing a little bit of volunteer work with Church World Service. I had written some spotlights on various people who they had helped, refugees, asylum seekers. And it was in 2016, when everything in Syria was really coming to a head. You had Aleppo, the horrible images we were getting from Aleppo. And so I talked to Church World Service and I just said, is there anything that I can do? Are there any Syrian refugees I could meet? And I kind of had the seed of an idea for a book, but I wasn't sure if that would ever happen or not. So they graciously introduced me to Muhammad. And the reason I tell this part of the story is because he had such an impact on me right away. When I first met him, we were sitting there and we had a translator at that point. He was only in the country for 2 or 3 months. And I remember I just wanted to, I mentioned the book, but I also wanted him to understand that it's kind of unlikely. Books are hard to come by. And so I said that to him. I said, it's quite likely that nothing will come of this, And through the translator, he said, oh, but that's impossible because we're friends now. And that had such a huge impact on me because I wasn't sure what he thought about me. I know what a lot of Americans think about Middle Eastern people. And I kind of imagined that the feeling would be mutual, that he would be scared of me or angry at me or, not really interested. And when he said that, it took me back, and I remember just sitting there for a minute thinking, wow, this guy is so open and he's so friendly, and I haven't done anything to earn that trust, but he's willing to trust me and to take a risk in making a friend. And that had a huge impact on me.
Wow. Well, this is still really fresh. It's only been 2 years. So, you know, it's not like this book is written 25 years, you know, later. We're really kind of in the swamp of refugees. Mm. In your whole process of going through this, what is one thing that just has like totally shattered your original thoughts of refugees and having them come in here to the United States?
Well, probably the most basic is a really simple fact that I don't think a lot of people know, and that being that refugees have to repay most, if not all, of their relocation expenses. So, you know, for Mohammed and his family, that's six airfares from Syria to the United States. I don't know exactly what the cost of that is, but it's got to be close to $6,000. You know, and then you're talking about first month's rent and all of these kinds of things that are involved in your relocation, visa applications and passports and all that. And they have to repay that. So, you know, they take out a loan through an international organization and then slowly pay that back as they're able to. And this was something that was that I had no idea about. And the more people that I tell, it seems like nobody really knows this or understands it. I think a lot of people sort of have this idea that, you know, it's costing us, you know, millions of dollars to bring these people to the United States. And while there are costs involved, and you know, I'm sure there are taxpayer funds that go towards some of those costs, a huge portion of them are repaid. So I found that surprising.
Yeah, it is very surprising. And I would agree with you. I don't think a lot of people know about the repayment back. You know, I think, honestly, people think they come and just kind of live off of us. Mm-hmm. And that's the stigma to it. Yet, that's not how they come. Most of these people come ready to work, ready to give of themselves. And like you said, that's not impossible because we're now friends.
Yeah, he was so... one of the things that I realized early on was how proud he was of how quickly he started working and how quickly they became self-sufficient. You know, I think they have 120 days to basically get to the place where they're paying off all of their own monthly bills. And so he had this plaque that he had received from Church World Service that said, you know, Mohammed has reached this point and, you know, congratulations or whatever. And when he showed me that, he was very quick to say, oh, I did it in 80 days. Like, I, you know... so that's that. You're right in that they want to work. This is not; these aren't folks who, you know, have grown up on a welfare state or, you know, have been helpless or relying on society to take care of them. I mean, if they do rely on society, it's their friends and family who have been taking care of them. And so when they arrive here, they want to work. They want to get jobs. You know, he and Maradi, his wife, were working immediately and working jobs that most people that I know wouldn't want, for wages that are really tough. So yeah, they're very hard workers.
Well, in your getting to know Mohammed and building this incredible relationship, what was something that you couldn't fit in your book because you're kind of constrained a certain amount of words that you want to share?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably more recent things that have happened. So, you know, after we finished the book and went off to the publishing house, just this past spring, he and his family moved to Michigan. So they moved, you know, 12 hours away from me, from our family, which has been hard. We talk on the phone probably once a week or so. And so that hasn't been fun. He was looking for... There's a huge Arabic population outside of Detroit. I think it's in Fairborn, that area. And so initially they moved into that community, but the housing was pretty rough and they he found that his boys were speaking Arabic more than English, which he didn't really want. So they moved a little bit further outside of Detroit, more towards Grand Rapids. And that's been a good move for them. They're settling in nicely. But every time I talk to him, he's like, "You got to come visit me." And I'm like, "Muhammad, it's 12 hours away." And I'm like, "No, you have to move back to Lancaster." And I think that if he had it all to do again, I think he would probably stay in Lancaster. But yeah, so I think more recent events would be nice. I have people who are always asking, you know, "So where's Muhammad? How's he doing? What's going on?" And yeah.
Well, it's really neat to see the other side because, you know, it's unfortunate what the media blasts at us, whether it's through our social media feeds or what we get on the traditional television or Hulu or Netflix or whatever, YouTube. What is it that you would kind of like to shake the pot a little bit when it comes to the stigma with refugees and neighbors?
Yeah. Well, for me, I have a real soft spot for Middle Eastern people and Muslims in particular, just because I've gotten to know so many of them in my life through a lot of the co-writing projects that I've done. So I met, I lived in England. My wife and I lived in England for 4 years and became very good friends with a Muslim couple there and got to know, you know, why they do what they do and how they live and that sort of thing. And then I had a co-writing project that I did in Turkey with a Christian missionary who was dying of cancer. And I spent 3 weeks with him. And while I was there, I got to meet all of his Turkish friends, and they call them family. And they were all Muslim. And they were just so welcoming. I was totally blown away by how hospitable they were and how welcoming. And then I got to meet Muhammad. I've been to Iraq on a co-writing project. And everywhere I go, you know, even into some of the scariest parts of the world, as far as we would be concerned, all I've ever met are Muslim people who are welcoming and kind and friendly and excited to meet people from other parts of the world. And so I just don't see this. I just don't see the stereotype that we've kind of been spoon-fed, you know, that Muslims are inherently violent, that they want the West to fall, that they're out to get America. You know, I haven't seen it. And the more places that I visit and the more Muslim people I get to know, the more comforted I am in that.
Well, it's interesting because you can really feel that within your heart, Sean, as you speak mm-hmm. about it. I do think we have this fear factor that people kind of live off of, and it's what we don't know that scares us. I don't know, what would you tell that person who is kind of struggling, you know, honestly, if they're going to be honest with themselves? Because here at Create Your Now, we're real and raw. I believe that if we dig deep, it's a holiday season. Let's talk about the heart. What mm-hmm. can we do? What would you share with that person who's like, I don't know that I can reach out, get to know someone that's not like me?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that we can do is pray that God would give us opportunities to cross paths with people like that. I have an older friend who I'm not going to identify, but she realized in the last couple of years that she had some very racist tendencies in her that she hadn't really recognized. You know, she had grown up with parents who grew up in the Deep South, and, you know, her great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents had slaves. And so this had been passed down through the generations to a point now where she didn't even really recognize it. But as she started to wonder if maybe that was true, like maybe I do have feelings of racism, maybe I do treat African-American people in an unfair way, she was wise enough to start to pray, God, help me in this. Like, give me an opportunity to work through this and to see how I'm feeling this way and what I could do better. And within a couple days of her beginning to pray this, two little black children showed up on her doorstep one day. And she was like, what are you doing here? and they were new neighbors. So the house next door had new people had moved in, and the mother worked until 5, and these kids get home from school at like 3:30, and they needed a place to go. And they showed up on her doorstep, and she said, sure, come on in. So they came in, and she gave them some after-school snacks and started spending time with them. And, you know, it was remarkable that within a couple of days of her praying this prayer, she was now becoming friends with their neighbor. She watches the kids most days after school. They just come on over and make themselves at home. And so I think that for most of us, that would be a great first step, would just to say, God, I can't see my own weaknesses, but help me to meet people who will help me work through these things.
That's incredible. And, you know, I believe a lot of us, we live this sheltered life. And what we don't know is what does scare us. And so being able to pull that back, and God has a way of coming in just at the right time when we least expect it.
Yeah. We're scared of what we don't know, you know, and I don't want to mitigate or, you know, completely varnish over the fact that there are people in the world who want to do evil things, you know, and so there are scary things in the world that we have every legitimate right to be afraid of. But I think as Christians, we have to be careful that we don't let those fears lead us in a way that isn't the way of Christ. You know, if I'm not a Christian and I say my number one concern is security and taking care of my family above and over everyone and everything else in this world, I don't know. That would be hard to argue with, I guess. But as Christians, we're called to put other people first. We're called to love our enemy. We're called to, you know, make these difficult decisions and move into places that we're afraid of. And so I think we need to be aware of that and looking for that and willing, you know, to make some difficult choices.
Well, you all are going to want to pick up your own copy of Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with the Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. There are many stories that you share in here about Muhammad and his family. And we're not going to tell all of them because they've got to read the book. But I do want to quote you on something here. And this was something that you learned towards the very end. And you say this: there's one thing I know for sure. If you insert me into the story of the Good Samaritan, I'm not only the Good Samaritan, I'm not only the one who stopped to help, I'm also the man lying along the side of the road, beaten down. I'm the one dying from selfishness and hypervigilance and fear. For those who maybe don't know the Good Samaritan story, can you share that a little bit? And then what in this story of your friendship with Muhammad, what brought this all about?
Yeah, I love the stories of Jesus because there's so much depth to them and there's so many different angles. And so this particular story, The Good Samaritan, a lot of us have heard it, but sometimes we forget that it came out of an expert in the religious law coming to Jesus and trying to justify himself, really, and saying, okay, if the greatest commandments are to love the Lord my God and to love my neighbor as myself, then who is my neighbor? You know, he's trying to figure out, it seems like, what's the least that he can get by, or who are the fewest number of people that he can love and still be a good believer, a good follower of God. And Jesus kind of turns it on its head and says, basically through this story, that you have to love your enemy. You have to take care of people who would persecute you. You have to be willing to shelter and to provide for people that you wouldn't normally want to do that for. And so, you know, thinking through that story, and again, just the many layers to these story that Jesus tells, I think so often we place ourselves in the positions of certain characters, right? So like in the prodigal son, it's really easy for us to think of ourselves as that prodigal who's come home. But a lot of times we don't want to think of ourselves as the older brother who, you know, was not very welcoming of this prodigal who came home. And I think the same can be said of in the story of the Good Samaritan. I think a lot of times we want to see ourselves, or, you know, Jesus is challenging me to be the Good Samaritan. But what I realized with Muhammad was that in many ways he was becoming the Good Samaritan in my life, and I sort of had to see myself as the person who was being helped. And that was a huge revelation to me, you know, to think that I'm not necessarily the strong one in this relationship. I'm not necessarily the one who's maybe living the way that he should live, you know. Actually, oh wow, look, it's Muhammad. He's welcoming me. He's inviting me over for dinner. He's spending time with me, you know. And that was a really interesting revelation for me.
I think it's really important that we really listen to that, because like you said, we like to put ourselves on the better side of things.
Yeah.
It makes us feel good, right? It warms our heart. But to say that, no, wait, maybe it's not what I really think it is. Maybe there's something here and it's looking at the stories differently. That's why, I mean, God's word, it's so living. I mean, it's alive because every single time we pick it up and you grasp this in your book, what's one thing as you were going through the process, you know, because you went there, right, with the intention of writing a book when you first met him, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
As you were in that process, though, when did that switch flip for you that there was more than the book and this is a chore or a job now?
I think it was when we first started to receive offers on the book, it came home to me that, you know, this can't just be a project for me. Muhammad deserves more than that. He deserves more than just being the subject of a book, you know? And I remember I tell a little bit of that story in the book where I turn to my wife and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. Like I can write this story, but I don't know if I can be a friend. You know, I don't know if I have time for that. I don't know if I even want that in my life. And then she said, well, then you definitely should write this book. and so I think that was kind of for me when the switch flipped, and that I realized, you know, this book is going to come and go. It's, you know, people are going to read it and hopefully they'll take something from it. But at some point the book is going to fade. And what, then what, you know, what's left after that? Is it going to be, is the bigger story just going to be about me using Muhammad's story to get a book deal, or are we actually going to have a friendship that goes beyond that?
I think you know that answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you'll just have to make that 12-hour drive.
Right, yeah.
Maybe you can be in the middle.
Yeah, it was nice because my publisher's in Grand Rapids, so I've been out there a couple of times since he moved, and once with my wife, Miley, and so we were able to go to their house for dinner, which was really nice. And then the second time, I didn't have a car. I flew into Grand Rapids, and he was still about 2.5 hours from Grand Rapids, but he was more than willing to drive in and see me, so we were able to spend the morning together before I flew home. So it's, I definitely, you know, there's something about Muhammad, there's something about our friendship that is different than any other friendship that I have, because I don't know, I mean, I have some really good friends, but I don't know if they would drive almost 3 hours to have breakfast with me, you know, like, and I don't know many friends that I would drive 4 or 5 hours out of the way to have dinner with, you know, so I think that's, like I said, I think Muhammad just continues to teach me about friendship and the importance of people in my life and, you know, what lengths am I willing to go to stay in touch with the people that I love and to see them face to face. So,
It's pretty incredible. I mean, I do. I genuinely love your book. And the story is, it's not just a story. I mean, this like really happened, you know, and that's what makes it even more kind of heart piercing, gut wrenching to the point of, yeah, we can have this. In your book, though, you have a lot of coffee in your book. There's a lot of drinking coffee. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Which I think is funny. I don't personally drink coffee, but I think it's great.
I don't either. I don't either. That's the problem.
So what did you drink when you had coffee? Did you
still have coffee? Well, I did. I drank coffee with him, but I don't. It's not something I drink on a daily basis.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, how would you look at the drinking coffee? And it's symbolically in regards to friendship.
I think with that, it's about being willing to put the other person first. So, you know, for me, like I said, we all have such busy lives. I would pull up to Muhammad's on an errand, you know, with something to give him or something that I needed to pick up. And if it was any other friend, we would stand on the stoop for 3 or 4 minutes, catch up really quick, you know, get what we needed, and then I would hop back in the car and drive away. And that just wasn't going to happen with Muhammad, you know? And I learned that early on and realized that that was important to him. You know, when you show up at someone's house, you don't just show up and leave. I mean, that's just not how they do things. And so drinking coffee was very symbolic of me working through my own selfishness and getting to the place where, you know, I'm just going to take a deep breath, stop my day for an hour or so, and sit here and chat. And, you know, I think what thing I'm thinking about just now, which I didn't even think of before, but we have more time than we think we do. You know, like we can make time for people if we just decide to do that instead of running around like chickens with our heads cut off to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, because I didn't miss anything. You know, I didn't miss out on things when I would take that hour, 2 hours and just sit with Muhammad and chat. I don't look back and think, oh man, yeah, I missed that meeting, or I didn't get to go to that kid's activity, or it was really just about me being willing to make space for someone else. And so I think that's kind of what the coffee represented to me, and especially because, like I said, I don't drink a lot of coffee, so to drink a cup of Turkish coffee at 9 o'clock at night was, I was giving something up in that case.
Well, that's awesome, but that just shows, though, I believe that is walking and being Jesus's feet and his hands. Yeah. Is that we're showing up, and a lot of us just use these excuses that I don't have time. I'm too busy. How are you? I'm too busy. I'm so busy that I can't even be talking to you right now. Yeah. The holidays are here. We're about ready to break into a brand new year. What's one thing from your relationship with Muhammad that you would say you want to carry into the brand new year?
I would like to get back in touch with my friends at Church World Service and look for another opportunity to enter into this kind of a friendship, just because now that Muhammad's in Michigan, you know, I don't have that anymore. And I feel like while it asked a fair amount from us as a family, as far as time goes and those sorts of things, it was such a rewarding experience, being involved in a refugee's life and, you know, just being around. And like I said, not necessarily giving them tons of money or, you know, giving them things that they wanted, but just being there. So I think for 2019, that's something that I would like to do is to start to explore that again.
Well, how exciting. And who knows, maybe another 2 or 3 memoirs.
Yeah, right.
Except I don't know what your calendar looks like, but I'm sure it's already packing up.
Yeah.
Well, what has God taught you, Sean, through this whole thing, especially in your weakness of being a friend?
I think it's a lot of the things that we've talked about as far as you know, just am I willing? You know, am I willing to make time for other people? Am I willing to stop in the middle of my life and have a real conversation with someone or welcome someone or encourage someone? I think that's something that I still carry with me a lot, and I ask myself a lot, because I live a pretty, I mean, I'm self-employed, so I'm home a lot. I spend a lot of time running my kids here and there. So a lot of my life is very inward focused as far as our family goes. And I think that's been the challenge to me is, you know, how can I make some adjustments to my life? Not just one-off stuff, you know, like, I mean, it's relatively easy to, you know, go down to the soup kitchen and volunteer on a Saturday, or it's relatively easy to, you know, raise some money and give it away, or put together a backpack for back to school things. And those are all important things. But I think if we really want to see change in our lives, positive change, then we have to start to do things that get tangled up in our lives, things that take up more time than just a couple hours on a Saturday morning.
Mm. They get tangled in our heart.
It
begins to drag you in and pull you in a different way. And think about it. God wants to be tangled up in our life. When you think about Muhammad, he doesn't have the same belief. I mean, I'm making that assumption as to what you do. And in writing this book and learning, yet God used this whole process of you all basically being on two different sides of the earth and bringing you together. And not only entangling God's heart with yours further, but Muhammad's heart to yours.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. You know, it really is how God can cause our paths to cross. You know, I mean, me sitting here speaking with you this morning, and who knows who else. I have a lunch on Friday with a Somalian refugee. And I think if we just open up ourselves, if we become willing to meet people who we don't understand or who make us maybe feel a little uncomfortable, you know, that's when exciting things start to happen.
And you said it best, am I willing? Maybe that's your question for the new year. Am I willing?
Yeah.
I love it. I think I'm going to take on that question too. I know you all will want to pick up your own copy of Once We Were Strangers, What Friendship with the Syrian Refugee Taught Me About Loving My Neighbor. Sean, I know people are going to want to connect with you. Where can they find you?
I'm on most of the social media sites. My website is seansmucker.com, S-H-A-W-N, smucker.com. I have a contact button there. I'm not sure if it works, but you can find me at most. If you Google me online, you'll find me.
Well, we'll be sure to have all that information in the show notes. Now, before I let you go, I have one final question for you. The series is called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
I would say that my story has gifted me with new questions to ask, with new sort of fields of myself that I need to explore and find out more about. I'm realizing that, you know, through this whole thing, I became very much a champion of refugees. And I think it became easy for me to become really frustrated and sometimes angry with people who don't understand that position or who actively fight against it, who are trying to keep refugees out of our country. And so I think what I'm starting to understand is that I need to remain open to listening, even and especially to people that I disagree with. So this has been a good process. The story has really taught me that. That, you know, even though I feel strongly about this topic and I feel like I know God's heart on it, that I still need to listen, and I still need to be kind, and I still need to be open, even to people who don't see things that way.
Well, I know, Sean, people are going to be very blessed by reading your book. And I want to really encourage people to pick up a copy, an extra copy, and put it in the stocking. Once we were strangers, you know, maybe you moved to a new town recently. I know I recently relocated. And when you were talking about Muhammad, and, you know, you were saying there's all these opportunities. You can get food. You can get a car. You can get loans. But what do we need? We need relationships. Mm-hmm. And God built us as relational beings. And we've got to remember that. And we've got to sink our teeth into it. And so I would just encourage everybody to pick up an extra copy. Read one for themselves. Put one in somebody that you don't know. And just bless someone this season and into the new year.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. You know, you just bring joy to my heart. And thank you for speaking out on something really challenging.
Yeah, well, thanks for helping me spread the word, Christine. I really appreciate it.
You have a blessed holiday season and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Same to you.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.